Well, that and in.
No.
Oh, okay.
Good morning. I'd like to bring to order the House Interim House Committee on Business and Labor. And good morning. Thank you for being here. We're going to get started right away. We have a little bit of business to take care of first, and that business would be taking a motion on adopting the House Interim Committee on Business and Labor rules for the 78th Legislative Assembly. So could I have a motion for that?
Mr. Chair, I move adoption of the proposed rules for the House Business and Labor Committee.
Representative Kinnemer proposes that we and moves that we adopt the proposed rules as distributed for the 78th Legislative Assembly for the House Interim Committee on Business and Labor. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection to adopting the rules? Seeing none, the rules are adopted. Jan, I think you wanted to point out.
I do, Mr. Chair, committee members. Each of you have this before you. This is a sample of a publication that Committee Services produces after every long session. It's about a 200-page document that is a summary of significant legislation, not all of it that passed, but Committee Services tries to identify bills that received a lot of attention or that would have had a large impact, and you can, the blue sheet tells you where you can find it online to review it, and if you would like a printed copy, Community Services will provide you a printed copy, so please let me know. But here's I just pulled out one sample. This is from the first page of the labor and employment section. That's it.
Thank you, and publications are really helpful for those that are trying to jog their memory on what we did in the past, which I'm always trying to remember. So, committee,
some of
we have.
Try to forget.
And some of us try to forget. That's true. It's much easier to forget than to remember, though. I will note we have a pretty full agenda, interim committee, informational meeting. Fairly interesting, I think, and sort of aimed at discussing employment, income, and wage trends, and some of the looking forward to having a report from the Small Business Assistance Program. And with that, let's go ahead and get started. Graham Slater is always a great one to start with this morning, so we'll open the informational meeting. And we'll have up Graham Slater and Nick Belichick. Good morning. Thank you for being here Monday morning.
Monday morning, bright and early.
Yeah.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Graham Slater. I'm the Research Division Director with the Oregon Employment Department. And with me this morning,
I'm Nick Belichick, State Employment Economist for the Oregon Employment Department.
So a little bit of context for the members of the committee. About 6 weeks ago, Nick and I were invited to share some information, particularly on minimum wage and a bunch of related things, with an informal work group that Representative Holvey and Senator Denbro and some other folks were present at. That was a two-hour presentation with a lot of discussion, and then Nick even went back later, a few weeks later, and shared some more information. This morning we've been asked to just bring back a slightly abridged version. We're looking at maybe 90 minutes, maybe less, depending on the amount of questions and the chair's desires.
That's the abridged
And after discussion with Jan, we've sort of reflowed it a little bit. So what we'd like to do, I'll start off by just sharing some pretty quick context. I mean, we could go right to minimum wage, but there's sort of a bigger economic context that I think is worth sharing. So I'll do that for the first 10 minutes or so. Then Nick will take the bulk of the presentation on the detailed minimum wage information. And then I'll wrap up with just a few comments about our projections and where we think things are going in the next, say, 10 years, which is really good background information for this committee, again, sort of in addition to the minimum wage stuff. So you have copies in front of you. Obviously, most people can see the screen. So our style, particularly mine, is to move pretty quickly, so don't be shy. I'm sure you won't about interrupting as we go. About 10 days ago, we released the unemployment rate and employment news for August. And it was another in a string of months that over the last 12, 15 months, it's just been really good news. And some of you have heard me testify before, particularly during the very slow recovery from this, you know, the huge recession. And year after year, it was either employment going down or else we were seeing very slow recovery. And that's changed. So we just wanted to sort of make sure that that message gets through. The unemployment rate, 6.1%. Yeah, you know, you may have seen it drifting up the last few months. That's because it really plummeted early in the year, and this is sample-based statistics. It can do that. But 6.1% for Oregon is a very low rate. It's a sign, really, of a pretty great economy. And for our state, getting down towards as low as it gets. And then also these two other pieces of information, the number of people who are unemployed for a long time, 26, 28, 50 weeks, whatever, that was really high during the worst of the recession. And it's now way back down where it was before the recession started. So that's a really big change. And
Mr. Chair, I have a question.
Sorry. It'll be quick.
Good morning, Representative Evans. You have a question so early?
I do. Sir, when you say 6.1% statewide, what's the delta between rural and urban?
Okay, Chair Holby and Representative Evans, the unemployment rates right now, and actually a later slide will show you some of those counties. Curry County is up towards 9% right now. And in a normal, you know, different times of the year, some of the eastern Oregon counties will be sometimes 10, 11%. So, as I recall, Benton County is on the low end, 4, 4.5%.
Okay.
So something between 4 and 9-ish would be the current range. At times, it's been much bigger range than that. That's where we are right now. Okay. Thank you. And then, so long-term unemployment down to sort of pre-recession or early recession levels. And then these part-time workers, the involuntary, they're working part-time even though they want to be working full-time. So that's also a sign of people who aren't getting what they really would love from working and from the economy. And that's also down at a much lower level, back to those 2008 levels. So it's not just the rate. It's all these other things that have to do with unemployment that are improved. And then job growth, we made a big deal of this in the news release. Job growth is up over the month. It's been up almost every month for a long time now, and up 3.5% over the year. That's the best percent growth over a 12-month period since 2005, and the 60,000 jobs added is the best since the late 90s. So all of this just sort of emphasizing for you that we really are in good times now, and there's always things to worry about. There's always things that aren't as good as we'd like, but overall, these are really good times. Here is the next slide, the very next slide, the unemployment rates. And again, Benton County 4.6, Curry County 8.9. The darker shading are the counties with the higher unemployment rates, and we often see Crook and Grant counties in that higher group, some of the metro areas in the lower ranges. But again, the worst of the recession, some of the rural areas were up in the 16-18% range. So to see Curry County as the highest at 8.9, I mean, it's not great, but it's a lot better than 18.9. Obviously, we've come a long way. Employment here, just emphasizing two things for some of you that are fairly new. When you look at that decline that you can see just, you know, a little back in from the right of the graph, that was the job losses at the beginning of the recession, and some of you have seen slides like this many times now. The great thing is we have now shown this kind of growth in the last year. We're beyond where we were before the recession started, and we waited a long time to get back to that pre-recession level, and now we're sort of surging beyond that. One of the things we hear a lot, and I've been around long enough to have heard this in almost every recovery, is people will say, well, yes, there's more jobs, but they're not very good jobs. They're low wage, minimum wage, part-time, low skill, whatever. There's sort of a whole list of things. And we love to show this graph. This is employment growth over the last year. And it simply makes the point that there's been jobs added in a wide variety of industries, some of which are very high wage. So this is not all about just adding low wage jobs, which is sort of what you hear sometimes. This top group, professional business services, that includes janitorial service companies, but it also includes computer software and consulting and engineering and law firms and accounting. And the average wage in these is over $60,000. So by no means is that industry a low-wage industry. The next one down is the classic comparison, and one that Nick will mention in terms of minimum wage. Leisure and hospitality, to use the formal name, restaurants, hotels, bars, clearly much lower, many more jobs, but much lower wages. So the point here is not to say all of the new jobs are high wage. The point is to sort of debunk the myth that they're all low wage. Our point here is that there's wages across several different industries of different wages. And I would note, manufacturing is the fifth on the list there, which in some states would be unbelievable to see manufacturing growth.
Representative Esquivel, you have a question?
You have a breakdown of where you're talking about these good-paying jobs and then these not-so-good-paying jobs. But what's the bulk of the people going into? That's the key factor. You can create all kinds of jobs, but if they're at minimum wage, what does that help your economy?
Okay, Chair Hovey and Representative Esquivel, all of these jobs on this slide are jobs that are filled. So these aren't jobs that have been created and some business is sort of looking for.
I understand that, but okay. I'm saying is how many people get the $60,000 a year job versus the $29,000 a year job?
28,000.
The numbers of people.
Okay, Chair Hovey, Representative Esquivel, I don't have the total employment for each of these industries in front of me that we can easily get that to you. We've got data on that about who works in these industries, and we've also got data on who works in different wage groups within industries. So that's something
total number in each wage group.
Total number in wage group.
I'm striving for it. We can get that.
So Andrea, I know you're here. We'll take a note, and we can get you that.
Yeah. Thank you.
We can break out all of the workers in Oregon by their wages. So, okay.
Actually, it looked like she stepped out, so maybe Nick can jot that down. I think Representative Esquivel brings up a good question because these are averages, and may not averages as such may not tell the whole story.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Follow up, no problem. Thank you. Okay, so I'll keep moving. Job growth has returned to all parts of the state, so that's positive too, because certainly at some points in the recession, pretty much all areas were losing, and then at some points, some areas, often Portland, were gaining, but not other areas. And now this is for the 9 workforce areas, and you've probably had testimony about this over the years. As Oregon has redesigned its workforce system, we now have sort of a redefined 9 workforce areas. So some of our graphs reflect that. And you can see the number of jobs added here over these different areas. Portland, obviously, adding the most because it has by far the most number of companies and people, so there's no surprise. But when we look at that in a percent look, then Portland isn't the fastest growing of all of these. And in fact, this workforce area that's called East Cascades, it's really sort of this whole swath of Central Oregon from Hood River all the way down to Klamath Falls. So clearly some of the growth here is Bend and areas around Bend. But some other areas, too, have been doing well. Hood River, for example, has been adding jobs. And then as you look across the next one, Medford and so on, I think the point here is that a lot of areas of the state, on a percent basis, they are adding jobs in this past year, which, again, is a very positive turn from where we were maybe 1 or 2 or 3 years ago. I want to mention just a quick comment on vacancies. A few years ago, one of the criticisms that we faced was that we knew how many people were working in Oregon. We did not have any good data on how many vacancies there were or what kinds of vacancies. So about 2007-ish, we started an annual at the time vacancy survey, which we now do quarterly. And it's been a great addition to our data. And for example, the most recent numbers we publish showed that for this year, this spring, there were 53,000 vacancies in Oregon, the highest number we've ever seen. And very consistent with all those the information I just shared, right? Businesses are growing, they're adding jobs. Part of that is there's more vacancies than ever before. And the number at the very bottom is really interesting because 61% of those vacancies, according to businesses, are difficult to fill. So we keep hearing that. You know, the workforce system hears that over and over again. We can't find the workers we need. We can't find the workers with the skills we need. So we start in our surveys asking a few more questions. And this goes back to the 2014 annual data. And some of you have seen this slide or one like it before. But it just talks about how for some businesses, they simply don't get applicants. End of story. That's why they can't fill their openings. For others, they acknowledge that maybe the working conditions, for a variety of reasons, aren't that great. But if you look at the left-hand side, we sort of look at that as things that the workforce system maybe can do something to help. If people are lacking in qualifications or certifications or training, that's what the broad workforce system is all about. So we try to work with workforce boards and community colleges and share this kind of information also at the regional levels, not just at the statewide level. I mention this in passing just because the more businesses tell us they cannot find workers, and if they can't find workers over a sort of medium to long term, that obviously damages their ability to hire people, to pay wages, and to actually be successful in meeting their customers' needs. So it's a big deal for the workforce system. Last little background for me, and I'll explain this one. We showed this to the work group, and I think people enjoyed it. When I move to the next slide, you're going to see, and it's worth actually looking at the slide for this one as opposed to the paper, you're going to see these circles start moving across the screen up here. And the further one moves to the right, that tells us that it's becoming a bigger and sort of more important part of employment in Oregon in terms of jobs. The higher it goes, that tells us about the wages in that particular industry group. So you can see the one that's labeled right now is food services or restaurants and so on. Let's just keep an eye on maybe there's a little one hidden behind. There's a lavenderish one hidden behind two big circles up towards the right. Keep an eye on that. That one's wood products manufacturing. So I'm going to do this a couple times. First time, just sort of watch what happens as we go from 1991 to 2014 in different industries. Watch that lavender one as it moves to the left and gets smaller. The size of the dot is the amount of employment in the industry.
It's pretty much the same. See the screen better.
He doesn't care.
It was pretty much the same.
So one of the things you saw there was wood products. So, you know, the wages are still decent, but the number of jobs and the share of Oregon's jobs, which was when it moves left, it's just sort of moving further and further left. Well, food services and drinking places started out pretty big, continues to get slightly bigger all the time, but as a share of jobs, it moves to the right, which means it's even more important. And then look at computer and electronic products manufacturing. Not huge, not like a huge amount of the state's economy in terms of jobs, but look at the wages, almost $10,000 a month. So some of these may be of particular interest to you. The sort of pink one up towards the top right, that's professional services. And then the one that's almost on top of it is healthcare, ambulatory healthcare, doctor's offices and so on. And then one that I know some of you are interested in, the bright purple one is construction contractors, like special trades, carpenters, electricians, plumbers, that kind of thing. So this is relevant only in the sense of how did we get where we are today, even going back as far as 1991. So let's just run it one more time, and then we'll move on. You can watch whichever industry you think is interesting. You would have to assume there's some years where the computer industry has some pretty great bonuses when it suddenly jumps up and down. So here's a more traditional look at some of the...
Can I ask one question back there?
Go ahead.
On administrative and support services, does that include government?
Chair Olvey and Representative Borrego, no, it does not.
Okay, so this is just private sector.
Yes.
Representative Widener.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
So,
more question here.
I'm sorry.
Real quick, when we're looking at this as an economy in a whole, when you look at it in 91, everything's pretty compact and together, very well balanced. Mm. Now it looks like things are separating and we're starting to lose industries when they go back. Would that be a fair assumption?
Chair Hovey and Representative Widener, that's a good point that I hadn't really thought about, that it starts out that way. Certainly, as you look back, and even if we went way before 91, things like wood products were a much bigger part of the economy in terms of jobs, and we have seen them sort of become smaller as other things, and often things in that service sector like healthcare, they've grown so much, they've taken a much bigger share.
But if I may follow up. when you're looking at that, right there, everything's grouped. Mm-hmm. Then you're seeing everything break down. It's not. It's food manufacturing. It's wood products. It's general merchandise, merchant wholesale. All of that stuff has moved back where we only had three sectors that go ahead. So to have a vibrant economy, wouldn't we want to go back to 91 where everything's kind of grouped in there and it's well-balanced? Where now we're losing a lot of industries and sectors, it looks like, over a period of time. You have basically five different sectors that are going backwards and only a couple going forwards, or worth four going forward.
Right. Chair Holvey and Representative Widener, I think, you know, what this is reflecting is that long-term change in Oregon. If you look at the industries that have moved to the right, they're very much in that service sector, which is a discussion we've been having, you know, for 30 years. Health services, professional services, and down here, the restaurants and so on. So, yes, it does represent a change, a big change in Oregon's economy, even from 91, but certainly if we went back to sort of 81. Whether it's good or bad, I don't really have a comment on that. From my point of view, it is what it is. And there is no going back to 91 because the whole world has changed, the nation, Oregon, things have changed. So it's not like we could do something to go back to that. This is about understanding sort of where we come from to today.
Thank you.
One little comment.
Let's go ahead and listen to the rest of it. There's a lot of speculation on what could happen with this, so you know we can all make comments on it, but I'd like to get through the presentation.
So this one's the more static graph, and again, it just highlights a few of those industries. Some things that we already know, healthcare just growing and growing and growing at a good wage. Food services growing a lot at a lower wage, and some of the things I've mentioned. Construction took that big tumble in the recession, but has started to grow again. And then, as was mentioned, wood products manufacturing on this decline, still with a lot of really important jobs in the state, but certainly from where it was 10, 20, 30 years ago, the number of jobs is lower. The industry itself is still very important and often doing very well, but with fewer workers. So I'm going to hand over to Nick now, and we'll change the focus more to the minimum wage topics.
Before you go on, just a quick question about that for you, Graham. When you're speaking of the wood products industry, you notice a real decline in the number of jobs, but you also see the wood products, or not the wood products, but manufacturing in terms of electronic and high-tech industry also becoming a part of that. Is there a relationship of, for example, a mill? How many employees does it take to run a mill today versus 1991?
Chair Holvey, certainly back in the early days of my career, that was already starting. And that was the early 80s, where mills that previously had, say, 200 people were running with 30 people. And you imagine now how that's changed over the years. So the industry can be doing very well, can be producing more than ever, but with many fewer employees. And that's true across many industries. Mm-hmm. So, yes, that is definitely one of the things that's impacted Oregon.
Okay, Chair Holvey, members of the committee, I'm going to talk about minimum wage data, the information we have about minimum wage jobs and workers, and my goal here is to present the commonly asked questions that I get. I've received a lot of questions about minimum wage this summer, and if there's something I'm not covering here, we'd be happy to try to follow up if the data is available. Simple review of the basics. The U.S. minimum wage is $7.25 per hour. Oregon is $9.25 per hour. Oregon's is annually adjusted to inflation. In 2016, the minimum wage in Oregon isn't going to increase. It's going to remain $9.25 because there's been really no measurable inflation based on the index that it's linked to. And in early 2015, about 100,000 workers were receiving, 100,000 jobs in Oregon were paying minimum wage, and that's about 5% of all the jobs in Oregon. Oregon's minimum wage is the second highest, following our neighbors to the north, Washington State, which is $9.47 an hour. It also won't go up next year, but some cities have higher minimum wages, and recently there's been a lot added, but San Francisco, Washington, D.C., and Seattle's famous for having one of the highest minimum wage increases on the books right now. So go up to $15 per hour by 2017. Recently, New York State passed a minimum wage increase just for fast food workers that will eventually bring their minimum wage up to $15 an hour, but not for all workers, just fast food workers. So this graph shows Oregon's minimum wage over time. The dark area shows what Oregon's minimum wage was each year back to 1978. So for example, the minimum wage was $2.30 per hour in 1978. That's about $9 per hour in today's dollars. And that green line shows how Oregon's minimum wage has been historically linked to when adjusted for inflation. So you can see the historical zigzag pattern in the buying power of the minimum wage, which is increased by legislation in certain years and then eroded by inflation over time. Since Oregon's minimum wage increase has been linked to inflation starting in 2004, the buying power of the minimum wage has stabilized. So that's where that green line sort of flattens out. Now, this graph compares Oregon's minimum wage to the federal minimum wage. And Oregon's minimum wage has been higher or equal to the federal minimum wage since 1989. So mostly it's been higher. The exception was 1996 when they were the same. Oregon is not the only state with a minimum wage that's higher than the federal minimum wage. 29 states plus Washington, D.C. have minimum wages that are higher than the federal level. So this infographic shows the jobs in Oregon by wage class earlier this year. Each figure represents 1 percentage point of all jobs. So minimum wage jobs amount to about 5% of all jobs. We also are frequently asked about other wage ranges. So in this graphic, we show the number of jobs up to $13.50 and the number of jobs up to $15 an hour. So putting this all together, about 33% of all jobs pay less than $13.50 per hour, and about 39% of all jobs pay less than $15 an hour. Now, the share of minimum wage jobs has been remarkably consistent over the past 16 years, ranging from 4 to 6% of all jobs. So this table is just putting it all out there for anyone who wants the details. Sometimes there's suggestions that especially the federal minimum wage should be linked to the median wage. The median wage is where half of all jobs pay less and half of all jobs pay more. And the proposal that gets tossed around is that the national minimum wage should be set at half of the median wage. So that's just an idea, but I've been asked about it in Oregon. As it turns out, the minimum wage in Oregon has been nearly one half of the median wage since at least 2000, and that graph just illustrates that. It's not by design, it just happens to be that way. So this is not adjusted for inflation, but the top line shows the median wage in Oregon since 2000, and the blue line is the minimum wage in Oregon. Now, looking at the number, the share of minimum wage jobs by industry shows that minimum wage jobs vary considerably by industry. And I think this helps get at Representative Esquivel's question of it's not the jobs being added, but it's the jobs in the industry earlier this year. And most minimum wage jobs are concentrated in leisure and hospitality, particularly restaurants, retail trade, also natural resources and mining, which is mostly agriculture as far as minimum wage employment. And those three industries account for 26% of all jobs, but about 69% of all minimum wage jobs.
So those natural resource jobs include agriculture?
Representative Holvey. Yes, the natural resources and mining is agriculture and logging. And of course, is a big part of the industry in Oregon, but not a big part of the minimum wage jobs.
What percentage of the workforce, or do you have that data, of the agriculture industry is included in that? Because I believe that not all of the agriculture industry is included because they don't pay into the unemployment tax rules.
Yes, Representative Holvey, good point. This count of jobs is for jobs that are covered by unemployment insurance. There's some agricultural employment that's not covered by unemployment insurance, so if the employers aren't paying unemployment insurance tax on those workers, they're not counted here. I don't have a good estimate about exactly what that is, but it basically excludes smaller farms that don't hire a lot of ag workers.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is, in hospitality and leisure, many of these have substantial tips. Are you going to talk about that influence on wages?
Chair Holvey, Representative.
This just doesn't represent it very accurately.
This is a count based on what the workers are getting paid, and it should include their tips. So restaurant workers in Oregon have to be paid minimum wage, and then the tips are on top of that. That's not true in most states, actually. The federal minimum wage allows for a tip credit where the credits make up part of the minimum wage. So as long as employers are getting minimum wage with the tips, then they're meeting the laws. Here, this would be, if all the tips are reported correctly, then those minimum wage jobs aren't including tips.
And I have a clarification. And a lot of these are non-tip positions,
yeah,
especially in the hospitality and the hotels and that kind of thing.
Representative Holvey, Chair Holvey, Representative Daugherty, right, but I don't know based on this data. So, and as well as industry, we're often asked about for this information by employer size, and there's not a big difference when it comes to employer size in terms of the share of jobs that are minimum wage, but minimum wage jobs are a little more common among smaller employers. And just kind of randomly picking a point to compare employers with fewer than 50 employees, those businesses account for 33% of all jobs, but about 43% of all minimum wage jobs. So there's not a big dip, not a huge difference, but we're sometimes asked for this and do have that information. And we're also asked about the number of minimum wage jobs by county, so a regional look at it. And there's two common ways to think about this: the number of minimum wage jobs in an area, so the number, or the share of the jobs in the area paying minimum wage. And that's what this map shows. The darker areas have a larger share of their economy in jobs paying minimum wage. And for example, Harney and Malheur counties, nearly 11% of the jobs in those two counties pay minimum wage. But they're relatively smaller economies. In terms of the number of jobs, that's about 1,600 jobs. Now, that's the extreme on one end. Multnomah County is the extreme on the other end. Only about 4% of the jobs in Multnomah County pay minimum wage, but that accounts for nearly 20,000 jobs. Mm. So we also get asked about not just minimum wage jobs, but jobs that pay just a little bit above minimum wage. So we have that information also. This graph shows statewide the share of jobs by $1 wage group increments. So again, about one-third of statewide jobs. One-third of statewide jobs pay $13 an hour or less, so that's just the number we've been asked about, so I have it up there. That's statewide. We can also look at this by county. When looking at these lower-wage jobs, the county by comparison changes a little bit. Hood River County has the highest share of jobs that pay less than $13 an hour. And Multnomah County has the lowest share of jobs that pay $13 an hour or less. So it went from Hood River County, which had 44% of jobs paying $13 less, to Multnomah County, where about 26% of jobs pay $13 or less. So I don't want to go in through this county by county. So this graph, or this map, shows all the counties at one time. Again, the darker counties have a higher percentage of jobs paying less than $13 an hour. And if you're interested in looking at the distribution for your county, we have posted a tool that allows that on our blog, so you can look at the August 24th blog post, this website, and check out what that distribution looks like for your county. So we have great information on industries of employment for minimum wage jobs, the size of the businesses, and the areas where these businesses are located. But for Oregon, we don't really have solid information about the workers who are working these jobs. So we have to turn to a national survey that's conducted by the U.S. Census Bureau, which provides information about minimum wage workers at the national level. And some of the key points from that information is minimum wage workers are more likely to be women. Women are half the workforce, but two-thirds of minimum wage workers. Minimum wage workers also tend to be young. The median age is probably about 25, so half the workers earning minimum wage are half the minimum wage workers are under 25 and half are above 25. But there's a little difference by race and ethnicity among the percentages of minimum wage workers. So I like this graph just because it clearly shows that distribution of minimum wage workers by age and sex. A little more clear than just the numbers. Most minimum wage workers do not have a college degree. Half have no college experience. Another 30% have some college but no degree. Minimum wage workers tend to be part-time, so 65% of minimum wage workers are part-time. And most of the minimum wage workers, or half the minimum wage workers, are in food preparation and serving related occupations. So those occupations are 9% of the overall workforce, but 50% of, or about 50% of minimum wage workers are in food prep and serving. So other occupations with a lot of minimum wage workers are sales and related, transportation, and personal care services. Looking at trends in low-wage jobs over time, one of the first things I want to do is point out Oregon's minimum wage adjusted for inflation over time. Oregon's median wage adjusted for inflation over time. The median wage is where half the jobs pay less and half the jobs pay more. So it's a good indication of sort of what the what a normal worker might see in their wages over time. And adjusted for inflation, this hasn't changed really at all since 2001. This period captures two recessions and two expansions. So sometimes when I hear comments about wages during this expansion, when I look back at the historical data, it's not like it's really any different, at least over the last 15 years. So the great news is that real average wages have been on the rise lately. Over the last year, adjusted for inflation, mostly because there hasn't been much inflation due to really low gasoline prices. But that's looking at the average, and the average is really influenced by high wage workers. I'll bring up the average where this median measure doesn't change as much by high wage workers receiving raises.
And this graph does not take into consideration cost of living adjustments?
Chair Holvey, this, yeah, this is adjusted for cost of living over time.
It is?
It is. So averages are brought up by increases among very high earners, and they have been doing better over time. So this graph looks at inflation-adjusted earnings again since 1990. And these are sort of a group of workers who have worked all year. They've worked each quarter of the year. And it's not just their average wage. It also accounts for the number of hours they've worked. So it's their total annual earnings over the year. And since 1990, the lowest 10th percentile, that's the bottom line there, has increased 11%. The median halfway point has increased 4%. But the highest earners, the 90th percentile on this graph, has increased 24% in earnings since 1990. And these are measures of jobs where we look at how overall households are doing. So when we take into consideration the earnings of everyone in the household, this measure is median household income adjusted for inflation. Back to 1984, as far as this data goes, and it compares it with the U.S. And for the most part, Oregon's been pretty in line with the U.S. See, in the early 2000s, we had a rougher recession than the nation did, and that affected the median household income. Things look pretty good in the last year, 2014, but just because I have to do this, there's some so into it. There's a little bit of a change in the way they ask questions in 2013 and 2014, so you have this weird dip and the weird increase, which is a statistical thing. We'll see how that evens out over the coming years. But my point is this, the Oregon's household income is generally about the same as the U.S. household income. And comparing us with our neighbors, we're in the middle, below California and Washington, above Idaho and Nevada. So we often get asked about multiple job holding, like if there's not enough good jobs, are people having to work two jobs or more? And that certainly happens, but actually our measures of multiple job holding shows that it's not happening a lot more than it used to. And in fact, looking back, people holding more than one job is a little bit less common than it used to be. It did increase in Oregon following the recession, but it's back down to kind of historical levels right now. And that's about 5.7% of workers work two or more jobs at a time. So we also get asked a lot about part-time workers. So maybe if we show that the count of jobs is going up, are they full-time jobs or part-time jobs? And we do have some good statistics on this for Oregon. There were over 400,000 part-time workers in Oregon, and part-time here means they're working fewer than 35 hours per week. 62% of part-time workers are women, so part-time workers are more likely to be women. Teenagers are also more likely to work part-time, which makes sense. About 9% of all part-time workers in Oregon are teens, but they're just 1% of all full-time workers. And there isn't much of a difference in part-time and full-time by race and ethnicity. But we know something about the reasons that people work part-time when they're asked. They're most likely to say they're part-time they're in school or training, or they have other family or personal obligations. What we sort of are most worried about in terms of economic impact are those who are part-time for slack work or business conditions. About 13% of part-time workers say that's why they're working part-time, and another 11% say they're working part-time because they can only find part-time work. Over time, we're at a pretty normal level of people who are working part-time or share of workers who are part-time. It did increase during the recession, which is looks small on this graph, but it's quite a big increase off of the historical trend. And a lot of that, I think, has to do with the part-time, for economic reasons, or involuntary part-time workers increased a lot in Oregon, and more so than in the rest of the U.S. And those are people who want to work full-time and are available to work full-time, but they can't because there's not enough hours at their jobs, or they could only find a job that was part-time work. The positive news here is this number has improved a lot recently, and it's heading back near to the historical level. Folks who are employed part-time, even though they don't want to be.
On that comment you just made, it doesn't look like it's returned to pre-recession historical levels. To me, I mean, they're 80 to 100, I guess. Is that close enough to be considered historical levels?
Chair Holvey and members of the committee, It's pretty close enough. This is the number of workers, so as the economy and population expands, it may never get back down to that lowest level. If we think about how there's more people in the labor force now than there was before the recession, then we may not get exactly down to where we were.
So if that graph was in percentages, it'd be a little closer, is what you're saying?
Yes.
Thanks.
So that wraps up the minimum wage focus. And I think, you know, a couple things that we like to try to do. One is Nick and I don't have any advocacy role for or against changes and increases and all those things. Our role as part of the research division here, it's just to provide whatever information we can get. And as Nick says, it's been a really busy year for him, and he's sort of our go-to person on minimum wage because of all the interest in Oregon. So what you've seen here is it's probably not even half of all of the different information requests he's done, but it does summarize them. So as you have other questions, any of you or folks behind me, we're happy to do what we can to get either Oregon or national data that helps inform this discussion. So I think there may be one question, but I...
Yeah, Representative Widener, you had a question.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, my question would be on the minimum wage, because we have been talking about going to $15 an hour and things like that. As a company, they'll have X dollars for payroll. Say I have $30,000 or $50,000 a month for my payroll. Can you see bumping minimum wage hurting some of the middle management or some of the workers that have been there for a while from getting raises because the bottom has came up and kind of making salaries stagnant, or hurting middle management people or people that have been in a job for a while?
Chair Holvey, Representative Widener. I don't know how an individual business will make that change, but what we have to go on, or what I have to go on, is the historical data. And with these relatively small minimum wage increases that we've seen over time, there doesn't seem to be any big change with how it affects workers who are earning more than minimum wage. But saying that, we haven't seen a really large increase in the minimum wage, so I don't have anything to go on.
Other questions, I'm sure, that if the committee wants to, there's a lot of data in here, and you want to take time to look over this data and get your questions to Jan, and we'll submit them to the Employment Department for some answers at that point.
And they have a few more slides.
Where are we going?
Let me just wrap up where we're going. Right. So this is sort of back to that bigger picture thing, which, again, I think for this committee, it's just great if you're all pretty aware of some of these big trends. So every 2 years, the Employment Department makes projections that go out 10 years. Obviously, the folks at the Office of Economic Analysis, they do their projections, and that's what feeds your budget cycles, you know, mostly in the two-year cycle going out beyond that. So we just wanted to share, these are getting dated now. We're working on the next round of projections. They'll be out in the spring. But when we last did projections, we were looking at employment growing here, you know, 250,000 jobs over 10 years. Granted, that was coming out of still a pretty low level because we were still in 2012 when we started these. Four industries that were actually adding jobs. But in all four cases, it was our projection that even by 2022, these industries will not be back at their pre-recession employment levels. And that's an important one, because if you hear manufacturing's growing and construction's growing, that's true, and that's great. But in both cases, our projection is even by 2022, they will not have got back to where they were before the recession. So that's just sort of something to keep in the back of your mind. Some other industries will have gone far beyond where they were before the recession. The healthcare one, middle down the graph, the sort of green line, I mean, as we've shown on an earlier slide, healthcare just keeps growing. So again, we see this growth, which I've mentioned, professional services, high wage, healthcare, high wage. Some of the others, like trade and leisure, much lower wage. So again, this message is pretty important, that there's growth across a whole range of industries in Oregon as we look out into the future. And then one for you just to keep in mind, we try to throw this in almost every presentation we do. It is so easy to focus on the need for training and education and skill development to keep up with the growth in Oregon's economy, right? You know, we hear of a company, they're adding 50 new jobs. Oh, will there be enough workers for that company? A hospital's expanding, new jobs, will there be enough workers? But what this graph shows, that the new jobs is the blue here in this graph. So, you know, when they expand and we need brand new nurses, brand new manufacturing assemblers, those positions didn't exist before, that's the blue. But that's actually less than half of the need in Oregon for skilled workers as we look over the next 10, 20 years, because so much is going to happen. The top industry, leisure and hospitality, it needs a lot of new workers because a lot of people in that industry move on to something else.
Right.
They don't stay in leisure and hospitality their whole careers. But the next ones down, professional services, government, and healthcare, those are all examples of industries where people tend to stay, but they're actually an older workforce. So most of the red here, this replacement openings, as we call it, that's retirements in those industries. And we just, you know, when we talk to community colleges, workforce boards, we always make this point that as we think about the training that's needed across a whole range of occupations in Oregon, you know, from healthcare to construction and everything else, it's all about really replacing some of these people that 5, 10, 15 years from now, they will have moved on. So nothing to do with minimum wage, but just sort of a chance in front of this committee to raise some of what we think are the big policy issues for maybe a future discussion. So there's my contact information, Nick's, and our website, Quality Info, and we would be happy to follow up, you know, working with Jan. If you have follow-up questions for us, we'll be happy to submit those and get them back to you. So thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate that. I think we probably will have a few questions, judging from the past character of this committee.
Characters,
maybe, would be better, but I do appreciate this information. A lot of data involved in this that you can probably use to make any kind of argument. But I think it might be helpful now. We are going to consider bringing you back in November, maybe not you specifically, but to hear from the State Workforce Investment Board and what they're doing with some of their strategies around workforce. It may or may not include you. I'm sure you must have a piece of that. But Representative Kinnemer.
I just wanted to mention how helpful it was to have this hard copy, because looking at those slides and this was just very helpful to try and figure it out a little bit better and put some things together. So, thank you.
Yeah.
I don't know.
It's representative of the demographic of our committee.
Yeah, and I think maybe that, I was hoping you wouldn't mention that. Yeah, my computer doesn't work real well somehow.
I'm sure it's the computer.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you very much. I appreciate your input and being here on a Monday morning. Up next, we have a late entry into our committee, and really appreciate that. Saw the subject matter of a study done by Dr. Bruce Weber, so from Oregon State University. So appreciate him also making himself available to go over a little bit about what he's found. And welcome, if you just introduce yourself for the record, even though I just did.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Bruce Weber. I'm a professor of applied economics at Oregon State University. And I've been given the very challenging task of providing an overview and introduction to inequality in Oregon, talking about what some of the facts are about inequality and some of the causes and the effects. In the next 15 minutes, I'd like to do six things. Just talk about how we measure inequality generally, and then look at how equal or unequal is the distribution of income in Oregon and neighboring states, and how does it differ across our counties, and then how it's changed over the last century in Oregon, in Oregon and in the U.S. And then talk a little bit about the sources of inequality. Why is inequality going up? What are some of the causes of inequality? What are some of the effects on the economy and on society? And then finally, what can be done? And I'll be very short on what can be done, because that really is probably the task that you're going to set for yourself in the next
couple. Right. And for this presentation, I think it may be helpful for us to hold our questions to the end and write them down, and we can ask Dr. Weber that at the end.
Okay, so there are many ways of measuring inequality, and usually you'll see something called a Gini ratio, which is not a very intuitive thing, but it is a measure that talks about how overall income is distributed. I'm going to focus on two other things when I talk about inequality in Oregon, which are, I think, easier to grasp and to understand about the gap between those who have high incomes and those who have low incomes. And one is a ratio of the average income of the top 20% to the average income of the bottom 20%. That gives you a sense of the gap between those who are, let's say, upper income and rich and those who are at the bottom of the distribution. And the other thing that is commonly thought about in terms of inequality is the shares that go to the top 1% or the top 10% or the top 20%. And I'll look at some of those numbers as well, just for context. So the first information here is about the ratio of the mean incomes of the top 20% and the bottom. So it shows the gap between the sort of the rich and the poor, say. And the ratio of 12, for example, means that the average income of the top 20%, let's say it's $180,000, is 12 times the average income of the bottom 20%. Nationally, this ratio for counties ranges between 6 times and 48 times, with a median value of 12. So the average value for all across all counties is about 12 times. The average income of the top is 12 times that of the bottom. For Oregon, the ratio for counties ranges from 8 to 21, and we'll see who those are. And again, the median ratio is about 12. This is a map of the U.S. It divides all states into five groups based on on their ratio. The dark blue is the highest inequality. Unsurprisingly, California, New York, and then some of the southern states, Georgia, Louisiana, Mississippi, have high inequality. The cream-colored states have the lowest inequality. And Oregon, as you'll see, is a light green, which puts it in the second group. So our income is more equally distributed than the average state. Mm-hmm. And we're in the second group of five, below average, but above the bottom group.
That's interesting. They didn't have a handout on that.
Oregon counties have a much wider range of inequality than the states. And as you can see, the dark, this map divides the counties into four groups. The dark colors are the high inequality and the light colors are the low inequality. You can see, for example, that Benton County has, the ratio there is 21. So the highest 20% have 21 times higher average income than the lower, than the lowest 20%. But they're both rural and urban counties in this, in this high inequality group. Benton is the highest, Multnomah's next, Lane is after that, and then Malheur, Union, and Grant counties all have high ratios of average income of the top to the bottom. The lowest ratios are for most, these are all relatively rural counties, Hood River, Tillamook, Lynn, I guess, the, and so the four lowest are Malheur, not, I'm sorry, Malheur, they're Hood River, Tillamook, Morrow, and I believe Crook. So again, there's a, quite a bit of variance across the counties in terms of ratio of top to bottom incomes. So this gives a sense, the two main points of this presentation are that Oregon on average is lower than the average state, and there is a great variety of there's a great range of inequality across the counties. The final graphic here is of inequality over time in Oregon. Mostly when you see inequality figures, you see the last 30 years, because that's when inequality has really increased in the U.S. and in Oregon. What I thought I would do is go back along, I go back to the earliest data that's available on inequality, which was, is from the 1910s. Our income tax was instituted in 1916, and so the earliest data on income inequality is probably 1916. So what you can see from this, two points here, are the blue line is the U.S., and the bottom line, the red line, is Oregon. I think the two important points here are Oregon, again, as we saw earlier, is a little bit lower than the U.S. all across the whole century that we're looking at. But the other is that the pattern is basically the same. Oregon's pattern, we had high inequality in the 10s and 20s and 30s before the Depression. The Depression basically equalized income distribution in the U.S. and in Oregon, with the lowest inequality in 1950. Since 1950, inequality has increased in Oregon and the U.S., and has increased quite rapidly during the 80s and 90s. The point that we've reached in the early 2000s is the highest inequality we've seen in either, well, historically, for the data that we have. This is the share of income that goes to the top decile. I guess I should have said that first. So this percentage on the vertical axis is the share of income that goes to the top 10%. So started at 40%, the top 10% of the income distribution at 40%. Right now it's around 41%, got down to 30% to 1950. But there was there a question?
No, that's fine.
Take a question.
Yeah, we'll take our questions at the end.
It's fascinating.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
We did just add the presentation to OLIS for the committee members, so if it's easier to see on your computer, we'll be making it available to the public later. Dr. Weber wanted to make a few revisions.
Final improvements. I'd like to make a few revisions before I let it go. This is a large scale overview. What these graphs miss is what's happening at most of the activity here, both the declines over the early part of the century and the increases in the late part of the century are due to what's happened in the top 1%, which we can't see here. And even in the top tenth of a percent than the top hundredth of a percent. That's where the action is, and the wages of top income earners have top 1% has increased very dramatically since around 1970. While their capital income share has not increased greatly, but most of the increase is wages of the top 1%. This is not the story of coupon clipping rentiers, which was the story in the early part of the century. The story now is high income, high wage income for the top 1% and even the top tenth of a percent. Now, this is U.S. I don't have Oregon data on this, but this is sort of U.S. story. But I think it's probably the Oregon story as well, given the pattern is so similar for Oregon and the U.S. Wage incomes of the upper middle income earners have also grown slightly as a share. Wage incomes of the middle and the lower income earners have been flat or declined, both because the wages of skilled labor have increased more rapidly than the wages of unskilled labor. Because of the decline in bargaining power of unions has led to lower wages, and in part because the value of the minimum wage has, as we saw earlier, decreased. At some time periods, it looks from next slides like this is sort of flat, but at least there has not been an increase in the value of the minimum wage. So again, the story is mostly what happens at the top. And I think this is important for Oregon because a lot of our flexibility as a state in terms of policy probably doesn't have to do with changing that that dynamic. I'll get to policies in a minute. So causes of inequality. Okay, economists have a lot of explanations and some of them conflicting about what are the causes of inequality? And these are ideas. These are reasons that have been suggested for increases in inequality, and there are others that could have been put in here as well. But certainly, one of the drivers is technological change. Technology makes labor more productive, and because it makes skilled labor more productive than non-skilled labor, there tends to be a gap that grows between skilled and unskilled workers. Globalization certainly is another factor in the increase in inequality. Capital moves to where wages are low, which puts a downward pressure on wages here. Tax policy has also been an important determinant of these changes. The marginal tax rates on high income earners have declined from historically high levels, and preferential treatment of capital gains maintains this inequality. And mentioned the minimum wage before, the decline in labor unions, bargaining power of labor has shrunk, and so the labor capital share has changed. And I think also one of the things that many people have raised as a possibility is that during World War II and in the following decades, there was a social norm about the range of executive or the executive compensation relative to workers, which in some ways was mandated during World War II and maintained for another decade or so after. But starting in the 1960s, we've seen great increases in executive and particularly chief executive compensation relative to workers, which has driven this share of the 1% and others. So these are some of the reasons that economists have put out as why inequality might have increased. I'd like to focus on three effects of inequality, just to talk a little bit about what inequality does to the economy and to society. And I guess the first point is that inequality puts a drag on the economy. Higher income groups don't spend as much or as high a share of their income as low income groups. And so at any given level of demand, higher more unequal income means lower spending. So there is a drag that's caused by any unequal distribution of income. But of course, if people don't consume, then they save. And so higher income groups also save, and more than lower income groups as a share of income. And if these savings were invested in productive assets, that would, again, increase aggregate demand or would maintain aggregate demand. But one of the reasons I think that we're slow in the recovery is that because low-income people didn't have the income to spend, the people who wanted to invest then weren't investing in assets that would create more production and were looking for other avenues for their savings. And so both on the savings side, investment side, and on the consumption side, inequality puts a drag on economic growth. Several commentators have also raised the concern that high levels of income inequality have social effects, that they're socially disruptive and may erode the social fabric. I've named a number of commentators who've raised this, and their books have been written that suggest this is a concern. No one has identified the level at which this becomes inequality triggers social disruptions, and that certainly depends on context. But I think all of these commentators have raised a concern that we may be approaching this level, and it's really difficult to say. But I guess the point here is that high inequality may, in fact, is very likely to disrupt and erode the social fabric. And I guess the final point about an effect of inequality or the process of the dynamic process that started by levels of inequality are that inequality is cumulative and it's self-reinforcing. Once you start with income inequality only grows because as people are able to save more and create and generate more wealth and get higher returns, that in itself, and because the returns to assets of the rich are higher than returns to the poor, the assets of the rich grow more quickly than the assets of the poor, and their incomes then become more unequal. Okay, this is the final slide. What can be done about inequality? I guess I'd like to make three points here. First, that many of the forces affecting inequality are outside of state control. These are things, large forces in the economy that the state really and state policy can have very little effect over. And what the state can do is very constrained by the environment in which we live. We're next to Washington, we're next to California. Both workers and people, business owners, have choices to make, and they're affected by the rules that we make. I guess the second point is that any of the suggested ways of dealing with inequality will have conflicting evidence about their impact. And it's very hard to sort out. I mean, these impacts of policy changes like taxation and investments in education, minimum wages have multiple effects that are really difficult to tease out. And I guess I've listed a couple of things which people have suggested and which I wish you are also considering as policies that can advance the reduction of inequality or slow the growth of inequality, including taxes, investments in education, and the minimum wage. But and I guess I'd just like to conclude by saying that figuring out what the impacts of this is a challenging task, and I'm sure you'll get good advice and good counsel as you proceed with that. Thank you very much.
Okay.
Thank you for your presentation. And in part of considering those policies, it's always good to hear from, you know, our academic world as well. They don't really have a conflict of interest, except maybe the investment in education.
right. I could have left that one out. And but that.
I've seen the correlation.
So, I couldn't
resist the kid. One of the questions I have, I'll just start out with a question. When you were talking about the top wage incomes on your previous slides, did that definition include in it capital gain income?
Right. Representative Holvey.
It's not just strictly wage?
Representative Holvey, yes. It doesn't include capital gains. It included capital income and entrepreneurial income. It's not just wages and salaries. Although what's driven the increase, to my surprise, and I think to many people's surprise, has been the wage and salary income, the compensation packages of which includes wages and bonuses salaries and stuff. But it doesn't include capital gains. That's not not included in the income tax data that are used to produce these results.
Thank you. That's informative. Other questions? Representative Widener.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess a question, because we kind of went over a lot of different things that you covered, but I'm just wondering, have you done any comparisons with other states and policies and decisions that they've made, like what Texas is doing versus what Oregon's doing versus what California is doing? Because when you looked at the inequality, your two most probably progressive states, New York and California, have the largest inequality. So that would say policy decisions being made there are probably affecting that possibly. And how's that compared to Texas? It's going a totally different route. And then has there been any studies doing just a psychological effect? Because a lot of companies and people are driven by money. I mean, when I have a business, how much does it cost me to make this widget?
Right.
And that's what we saw in the automotive industry with, like, Ford, GM.
Right.
They had these huge burden. I mean, they had to make $10,000 on the car just to cover their wages and benefits and everything,
right,
and their pension plans. And it priced them out of the market to where foreign competitors could come in.
Right.
So have you really got into looking at that, or has it just been looking at inequality rather than getting to the root of what causes that inequality?
Right. Thank you. Representative Chair Holvey and Representative Widener, I have not looked at policies across states, and I guess I was asked to talk about inequality generally and tried to do that. So California, New York, Texas as sort of examples. A lot of what drives, I think, the inequality in New York and probably in Texas was not among the highest, but it was in the quintile right below the top. So it was, as I remember Texas, it was a blue.
No, Texas was one of the lower ones.
Texas was in the second rank, and I can go back to that. So the blue on this, it was not in the highest. I mean, that's exactly right. In other, actually, there are other maps. If you use other measures, Texas is one of the top 10 states. So it's the states with the highest urban concentrations, and some of the southern states that don't have urban concentrations is where the highest inequality is. Inequality tends to be higher in urban areas. Rich people live in urban areas, and the difference between the rich and the poor is greater in urban areas generally.
Actually, Mr. Chair, if I may follow up just looking at that map.
Go ahead. Another question?
One more question. You kind of look through it, and I'm just looking with what I do in the industrial world that I work in. That's where all of our business is across that whole southern, because that's where all the industry is,
right,
and all the anything that's happening is going across those states.
Right.
I mean, that's where 90% of our sales are, is across that area.
Right.
Which area? I'm sorry.
He's talking about
from
the
Texas, the southeast, from Texas across. I mean, that's where a lot of your refineries, your oil.
Right.
I mean, there's a lot of stuff.
A lot of poverty as well.
So.
Yes.
Representative Barreto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, along with Representative Widener's, you mentioned globalization there, and then the lack of or the lack of influence on with the unions. Don't those two go together? I mean, as far as where the unions may be overstepped, and then globalization allows manufacturers to go wherever they get it done the cheapest.
Chair Holby, Representative Breto. Yes, I mean that's large. I mean, I think part of the decline in unions is because globalization has put downward pressure on wages and downward pressure on unions. I mean, union organizing is much more difficult when the owners have options to move to lower wage areas. Yes, well, I think they're related.
And then one follow-up. And do you have a demographic breakdown on the higher income earners?
There are, and if I'd had more time, I would have tried to get that kind of data. They are available, because there is a lot of interesting below the top 20% or top 10%. I'm interested in that question and would be happy to attempt to get more breakdowns. We did see some of what in some of the slides from the Employment Department about wages and the wage growth in the top earners relative to the bottom earners. So there some of that is actually about wages is available from Employment Department. But I'm happy to look at the overall income distribution in a way that's below the 20%, and if the committee is interested, I'd be happy to.
Since you've made the offer and are happy to answer further questions, we'll probably accumulate some questions from the committee like we did for the Employment Department, give them to you and give you some time to respond to those if you'd be so willing, and then we can share that with all the members here. So, Representative Nose, question.
Yeah. The slide where you showed where equality started out, really inequality started out high, like for the data you had from like 1916, there it is, yeah. Right. Then we had a dip
right.
with the Depression
right.
and then World War II in the 50s.
Right.
And now it's even, I think, I was surprised by that because we think of the 1920s,
right.
the time before the recession is even greater inequality than we believe we're experiencing now.
Right.
So is your survey of literature suggesting that we're going to see we're at a tipping point potentially where we're going to experience some sort of depression or recession even greater than the one we just seem to be coming out of? Like, is that a predictor of things to come? Like, the inequality is bad enough that it's going to tip?
Okay.
Right?
Chair Holby.
You brought your crystal ball, right?
No, I guess the short answer is no.
Darn.
This is not a prediction.
Can't see the future?
This is a... I mean, the fundamental forces that drove this are partly depression, but partly it's the changes in rules that we've instituted since the depression that have allowed this to happen. And I mean, I do think there are fundamental economic forces like the ones that we talked about
yeah.
of sort of wage forces that affect wages. But there are also, we do construct rules that then we live within which affect the way that the income inequality happens. And the rules relate to taxation. They relate to all of the things that we looked at here. They relate to investments in education. So I think we, as a society, can affect the level of inequality. States have more limits than nations in doing that. Nations have limits imposed by the new global reach of business. And so what we can do is somewhat constrained, but it, still we work within that and can make some difference in terms of the level of inequality.
Representative Hurd.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for coming today, Professor.
Yeah.
One of the questions that I've had as I've been listening to your presentation is I'm hearing, you know, we're focused on income equality, as you referenced earlier. But, you know, when I looked at those states, as you had the map up earlier, like California, New York, Texas. In my mind, and it's a question, it's a statement and a question, but I would like your response. Those three states, you know, California has Silicon Valley.
Yeah.
It has Hollywood. Right. Those right. areas have right. industries that have huge income earners in them. Right. Wall Street in New York, right. The oil industry in Texas. Right. So obviously we all know there's people with tremendous wealth because of the industries they're involved in that are focused on those three particular states we're talking yeah. about. That's right. But I'm not sure that's really a true indication of whether people are poor that are not the super wealthy. Thus, is the inequality really that big of a deal, or is it more a big deal to focus on what are people towards the bottom to the medium income in those states making? When you look at a state like Alaska, when I was up there recently on a trip with my grandmother, I see a lot of retirees that go up there that are wealthy, but it's their second home. It's not where they're making their income.
Right.
The people that live there and earn an income there, I don't see them being tremendously wealthy. Yet on your map, it shows as tremendous inequality. So again, to me, when I come here to this building, I'm trying to figure out what policies do we need to enact that will help the people at the bottom rise up, not necessarily focusing on my rich neighbor. Can you give me some feedback on that and enlighten me?
Yeah, thank you. Chair Holby, Representative Hurd. So you pointed to some fundamental things that affect inequality, and inequality in this measure is the top relative to the bottom.
Right.
So it is both the top and the bottom, but it isn't a map of poverty incidence. It isn't tell you where the poverty map would look different than this.
Right.
And so inequality is talking about the gap, not the condition of people at any particular level, or particularly not at the bottom. It does imply that there's a high top and a low bottom. So, but you can't tell from this map whether it's the high top or the low bottom that's driving this.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
So, I mean, my conclusion from that is that the overall health of the economy is what's more important to me, and I'm assuming you as well, because, I mean, logically, basic math, we could look at a third world country that's everybody's just flat broke.
Sure. Right.
True equality.
Right.
Nobody,
that's
I would
right.
think, would right. want that.
That's right.
But they have equality.
That's right.
So that, to me, it just, the inequality situation isn't the big bear in the room to me. It's just the overall health of the economy. I want people to be rich. Right. I want everybody to right. be doing well. I couldn't really care less for myself whether my neighbor has a lot more than me. I just care about whether I'm making enough to be satisfied.
Yeah. Chair Holby, Representative Hurd, many times when this is presented, they'll have both this map mm-hmm. and the map of the median income that and a map sense. Of growth. I mean, those are things that if you were looking at a broad... What about the economy and the health of the economy? You look at much more than just inequality. But I guess I was asked to focus on inequality, so I did. But I think a fuller picture would have maps of where are incomes, average incomes highest, where is poverty mm-hmm. highest, where is the growth in the economy happening. So, and that's another 15 minutes.
Yeah, and we've had, thank you for that, and we do have maps from other, like the Employment Department's given sure. us some of that data in the past as well as the poverty information. Representative Kinnemer, did you have a question?
Yes.
Go ahead.
Yeah, it's been interesting discussion, and I guess, you know, my thinking is it's also really complicated, you know, and getting some of similar to what Representative Hurd said, you know, part of this inequity also creates the capital that funds expansion of the economy.
Right. That's right.
I mean,
that's
those right. who have assets beyond their needs end up investing them, and that's why we have a capital gain system of taxation, because we want that money to go back into the economy for startup companies right. and expansion and loans and all the things that create jobs. So it's... Right. It's one of the ironies that in certain ways the rich get richer and the poor get poorer, and yet the economy is that factor that we're trying to balance and keep moving forward. I think it's more a statement than a question. but it is really a difficult one that we argue with here, because if you're not careful, you tax away those benefits. You tax away that investment instead of creating the investment, and you subsidize the low income without the opportunity for advancement of work.
Yeah.
Great question.
Well, Representative Kenmer, I mean, you've identified something that I think I mentioned that is exactly right, that it is the people who have surplus income, in a sense, that they can invest. And the trick is to figure out how much of that to use for public investments and how much of it to leave for private investments. And and both investments are needed in order for an economy to succeed. And the balance, the trick is to figure out at what level you tax different kinds of income so that you can create a package where both private investments can flourish and public investments can support that.
But to follow up on Representative Kinnemer's point, I think you also brought up that without the demand from that lower income for consumerism, there is much less investment in those assets that create the jobs at the higher levels. And so that savings doesn't really get put back into the economy without that consumerism.
Exactly.
I think that was
one of the points. Yes. Thank you. Thank you, Chair Holman.
I guess I get the last word on this. I appreciate I guess that wasn't a question either, but I had to follow my vice chair. So with that, thank you very much for coming on short notice and sharing with us your study on this. I think it's very interesting and does provide some very useful information for us as, like you said, we will be looking at, you know, some of those other data to overlay, you know, poverty and median incomes and some of those sorts of things as we look at the state of Oregon more closely, seeing what kind of policies we may or may not be entertaining in the future. So thank you so much for coming this morning.
Thank you for the chance to be here.
For right now, I'm going to take a five-minute break before we hear from the Office of Small Business Assistance. So I'll started here. I'd like to reconvene our informational meeting for the Interim House Committee on Business and Labor. And up next, we have Ruth Miles from the Office of Small Business Assistance to give us a little presentation on an important segment of our economy.
Good morning, Chair Holvey, members of the committee. Thanks for the opportunity to testify. I'm Ruth Miles. I'm the Small Business Advocate for Secretary of State, and I run the Office of Small Business Assistance for the Secretary. As you may recall, the office was legislatively created in 2013, and we opened it in January 2014. I assist small businesses that have a challenge with an executive branch state agency, and that covers a huge spectrum of issues. You've got the report from my office up on the screen. You should have a hard copy in front of you as well, and I'll be talking about that during my testimony. Through all the inquiries that come from businesses, my priorities are clear. First job is to fix the problem for the business if it is fixable. Second, I'm looking for systemic issues that may cause the same problem to happen repeatedly. If I find those, I'll likely call them out in findings issued by my office to highlight the problem for the agency. Last, I report back, and that's what I'm doing here. I testified before this committee almost a year ago today, almost to the day, and mentioned to you then that my office gets multiple calls each day with simple sort of one and done questions. Most of these involve businesses that need a simple connection point with a state agency. Many of them are from folks that are just going to start a small business for the first time. I work closely with the Small Business Development Centers. In fact, I sit on their state advisory board, and I refer most of these folks that need help getting a business started to the Small Business Development Centers. They are a huge asset to entrepreneurs throughout the state, so I can't speak about them highly enough. In fact, Mark Gregory, their center director and the network director, and possibly John Downing, his deputy, will probably be in the building today and walking by your offices to say hi. though we get lots of simple calls, I spend most of my time working with businesses that have a complex issue with a state agency. They've done what they can to resolve the issue, to try and find their way through it or around it, and they've not had any success. In virtually every case, an objective third party to step in with a helping hand is an important catalyst for a solution. As you know, the Secretary of State is her own constitutional office outside the executive branch. As her appointee and by extension, I'm also outside the executive branch. This gives me the ability to work objectively with both state agencies and businesses to find a solution to their problems. Because I've met with many of you individually, you've heard about some of the cases that I've worked on, and you may recognize some of those that you see in the report before you as well. And you all have received this report before. It was distributed in February 2015 when we first released it. So your office would have received a copy of it then. Just a little bit about the numbers to date, because the report only addresses cases that came into the office, complex cases that came into the office during the 2014 case year. So I wanted to give you a sense of where we're at to date as well, to give you kind of a sneak peek for what happens next year. So last year we did 140 complex cases. That's what's in the report before you. None of those cases are currently open, but there were about seven of them open at the time we published this report. So some of those went over the calendar year. To date, so, and this is up till last Friday, we had 143 cases this year. 136 of them are closed. Seven of them are still open. And again, that's as of Friday. So that number could have gone up this morning. That number of seven open could have gone down. That's a number that changes very, very quickly. So you've got this report in front of you. You've got it on the screen. And I want to call your attention to the graph in the lower left corner. This describes the 140 complex cases that came in to the office and specifically talks about all of the cases by the type of problem. As I mentioned to you during my testimony last year, licensing and certification related cases, which are one category that's listed as licensing on your report, they represent the largest single chunk of cases that come to my office. Looking at the report before you, licensing and certification releases are 34% of the pie. That goes up and down, just like the number of cases that are open and closed goes up. Well, that goes up all the time, but closed certainly goes down. But this figure was 35% just a couple of weeks ago. Now it's back down to 34% to date. So still, that number is true. So to date, from January 2014 to last Friday, we've still got 34% of cases that are licensing and certification. The issue with licensing represented the first and most enduring trend that I've been able to identify with the data that our office captures for every case. This includes things like the location of the business, what state agency is involved, the type of concern, and that's how we get all of this for you. Because of the prevalence of these cases, I took that licensing chunk that you see there, that dark blue chunk of 34%, and graphed it out by agency. And that's what you see in the middle of the center column. You can see at a glance that at the top of that is Oregon Health Authority. They're in that position largely because of several cases involving in-home care agencies. When the first in-home care agency licensing case came to my office, I learned that the initial licensing process for these in-home care agencies was very slow. I'm talking molasses in January slow, really, really slow. Folks submitting a new application had to capitalize their businesses without any revenue coming in for an unknown period of time. And that might stretch as long as a year, possibly even more, depending on how prepared the business was and also on the activities of the licensing office. Since then, the licensing office has substantially improved their time frames. Last time I checked, it took an average of 3 months to get that same initial license for an in-home care agency from the Oregon Health Authority. I think that's a reasonable time frame given the necessary rigor of their licensing process. The most convincing evidence to me that they have largely solved the problems that landed them in this spot on the report is that I don't currently have any cases that involve in-home care agencies, not relicensing cases, not initial licensing cases. So I'm really pleased to show that we've made some forward movement in terms of policy. Second on that middle graph is the UMWSB office, the Office of Minority Women and Emerging Small Business. Later today, you'll recall the governor plans a ceremonial signing of HB 3303 that will rename the UMWSB office COBID, and it will also introduce a new certification for service-disabled veteran enterprises. Pretty exciting stuff, at least in my geeky world. You'll recall that COBID stands for Certification Office for Business Inclusion and Diversity. So as you can see, this 2014 annual report has not only data, but little snapshots of the stories behind the data, the real people, the real businesses behind the data. And those asterisk bolded paragraphs contain those quick snapshots. The UMWSB office first came to my attention when Julie, who's the owner of Energyneering, expressed concern with their certification review process through the UMWSB office. At the time this was happening, the UMWSB office was in the painful process of migrating from an all-paper system to track certifications to a digital system. And that got close to doubling their workload. It resulted in some communication problems with their already certified companies. And one of those that was highlighted, certainly in Julie's case, is that they failed to explain to already certified companies, particularly women business enterprises, or WBEs, I call them, that the standard for certification with the state had substantially changed. It was made far, far more rigorous in 2012 through a rulemaking process. And frankly, no one commented on the rulemaking process that changed the certification rigor. Not businesses, not legislators, not state agencies. Nobody had any comments. Because of HB 3303 that I mentioned earlier today, those rules are going to be opened up again, and I promise you I will be at the front waving a flag to every business association that I have connections with to make sure that they do comment on those rules and that they provide substantive comment. And perhaps those comments will have some effect on the standard for WBEs. Most of the businesses that were affected by that rule change have successfully gone through certification review because it happened in 2012. The certification process is reviewed every 3 years. So most of them have had no difficulty. A few of them have, and that's what you see up here on these cases. I do feel confident in telling you that the UMWSB office has successfully addressed most of the problems that landed them in this spot on this report. Certainly, they've finished their migration to the data system that they have, the digital system for certification. And I will tell you this, that their office has been really good about staying in communication with my office. Certification can be a really key part of growing a business, considering the government, whether it's the state, local government, or even the federal government, as a potential customer for a business can be a game changer. And I certainly have a personal story about that I tell businesses. Because of that, I feel like it's really necessary to keep in touch with them, and they've been great about that. One of the things that you're not going to see on this report is a graph of all of those 140 complex cases by agency. If you were to take a look at all cases by agency alone, you would see, at least to date, and certainly this was true when we released this report as well, the largest chunk involved the Department of Revenue. Every business has tax obligations, so it's not surprising that we'd see higher numbers for revenue than other agencies, right? But what is not immediately apparent, and what I couldn't figure out a way to actually tell the story of in this report, is that revenue cases are almost always solved the same day or the next day, depending on what time of day they come into my office. It is very, very rare to have a revenue case drag on and get difficult. Part of this is because revenue has assigned several employees at different levels within the agency to work with my office when an inquiry from a business comes in. In addition, they are among several agencies that have made an investment in outreach to the business community. They have a person who travels around the state doing free seminars on payroll and business tax compliance. Businesses love this service. I don't know how to bold that or underline or italicize that for you enough. It makes a huge difference for a business that isn't quite sure that they are in compliance to have the ability to go to a free seminar and understand how to get into compliance. So, and the other thing that this this does is it offers a point of entry to what can seem like a monolithic state agency, especially if you're a small business owner and you're doing everything. You're doing the HR, you're doing the books, you're doing the tax return, you're doing everything for your business. Also on this report is an interesting note about policy implementation issues that negatively affect business. And you can find that in the right-hand column, kind of middle, 5% of cases involve policy implementation issues that have a negative effect on business. And let me give you an example of this, and that snapshot's in here as well. I was speaking at a chamber event, and this was just part of my normal outreach activities to make sure businesses know about the services and resources of my office. And this gal asked a question. She raised her hand, and she says, I sell fuel. I sell gasoline. And I also sell a fuel called D20 biodiesel fuel. This is made from used cooking oil. She says, ODOT requires a lot of paperwork from me in order for me to sell just this one fuel. Can you help with this problem? During the 2013 legislative session, HB 2435 was passed. This bill forgave the state fuel tax on retail sales of B20 biodiesel to non-farm vehicles under 26,000 pounds. And that bill is, it sunsets in December 31st, 2019, I believe, unless that date has been moved up. The paperwork that is required by ODOT to sell this fuel only became burdensome because sales of the fuel skyrocketed past ODOT's initial projections that they gave the legislature about how much fuel would they sell if you forgive that 30 cents of state sales tax on B20 biodiesel. When I highlighted this problem for ODOT, they worked with their fuel sellers to quickly develop and implement a new reporting system. The inquiry was initially raised by the business in August 2014. The solution was implemented by ODOT, put in place a new reporting system on October 1st, 2014. Pretty nimble for a state agency. I was very impressed with this. They included their fuel sellers in creating a solution to the documentation problem, and by doing that, they widened their brain trust. And I would have to, the solution that the fuel sellers came up with is the one that ODOT implemented, and it is so elegant compared to what they were doing before. It is not only elegant, it represents a significant cost savings for fuel sellers throughout the state that sell this B20 biodiesel fuel. And it is fairly widely available now. You can get it in Ontario. You might be able to get it in Pendleton. You for sure can get it up and down the I-5 corridor in some isolated spots outside of there. This change saved this one business thousands of dollars per month. The whole industry, I don't have a figure for you, but man, I wish I did, because I think it would be pretty impressive. And I look at this as a win for legislators. You get the information you need to cover this tax expenditure and to watch what is being spent. ODOT wins. They look like heroes for solving this problem and doing it so beautifully. Certainly the industry wins, and they win big. You'll notice that the last section of the report, entitled Looking Forward, it's important to me that the work of this office not only document short-term problems that businesses are having, but also point the way on long-term solutions that are indicated by our casework. 100% of the cases that come to the Office of Small Business Assistance have poor communication at the heart of the problem. Usually it's on both sides of the equation. Not always, but usually. And it's because of this fact that I included this section in the report. I don't ever want the state to be the fault of a business not being able to thrive in our state. Agency communication can't just be about putting information on a website and hoping that business owners intuitively understand how they fit into a complex system of regulation. As a note for you, I actually sat in a meeting at a state agency where someone told me that they had redone the administrative rules, and that since all of the businesses involved in this system, this very complex system, were reading all of the administrative rule updates, they would intuitively understand how they fit into the system. It took me months to understand this system. Now, I'm not in the industry, but I think that that was a poor choice on the part of that agency, and I'm happy to tell you they now agree that that was a poor choice. They're not going to repeat that action again. Based on everything that I have learned through these cases, putting information just on a website or just in your administrative rules, as an extreme example, isn't a recipe for business success. And I think, based on casework, that what is a recipe for success is agencies that listen intentionally, that speak to business owners in our state with clarity and respect. That, and recognizing the simple equation that for business owners, time is money. They are not making money when they are on the phone with a state employee. They are not making money when they're doing paperwork for ODOT to sell one single fuel. They're only making money when our regulatory system is intuitive and easy, and that makes compliance easier. I mentioned earlier that the Department of Revenue has made a small but critical investment in outreach as an effort to improve communication with their customers. So has the Employment Department as a lead in the Interagency Compliance Network, which is a group of seven state agencies, along with ODOT and DAS. I can't emphasize enough how much businesses appreciate having a single point of contact for an agency, even if all that person does is shuttle their inquiry to the right place. I think it's probable that the number of cases that we would have had come to my office has dropped since these agencies have made that investment. One of the benefits to housing the Office of Small Business Assistance within the Secretary of State is access to technology. And so I have this fabulous case management system that allows me to track the data that I've presented to you today. In addition, I have now access to ArcGIS. And so that's what you're seeing on the screen in front of you now. My office recently completed mapping the cases that we have worked on through August and will, at the end of this month, do September. This map is not published online at this time, but if you are interested in learning about cases that have happened in your district, and I'm pretty sure, looking around the room, that all of you have had cases in your districts, let me know. I'm happy to tell you about the specific concerns that your business constituents have brought forward. So that's the high-level view of my my office activities during our still relatively short period of operation. I really appreciate this opportunity to walk you through the 2014 report, and I'm certainly happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Widener.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A little bit of a comment here. Ruth, proud of the job you've done with this department, and when we put it in place, it's going well.
Thank you.
Everything we've passed you and everything has been spectacular, and I'm glad to hear the Department of Revenue and everybody's getting involved, because I think we're raising awareness to what businesses are facing out there, because they want to do the right thing, but it's just tough sometimes because you get overwhelmed by the paperwork.
Mm-hmm. Representative Kinnamer.
Just wanted to say thanks. Mm-hmm. Number of constituent problems that we've referred.
It's a good offer.
Appreciate it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Chair Holdy, Rep. Kennebar, thank you very much.
No other
questions.
Oh, you have a question?
A comment. Just she's been in District 20, I think, four times in the last 7 months, holding different types of forums, and I just appreciate everything she brings to the table. Mm-hmm. Doing a great job.
Amen.
Chair Holdy, Rep. Evans, thank you.
Yeah, it's praise your office is, I guess, good to hear. We do appreciate what you're doing, and I think it really does lend us some information that we can act on to change policies that tend to be roadblocks. And certainly, I think you're identifying that communication with our agencies is really at the crux of a lot of problems, as opposed to the policy. But certainly do recognize that we can occasionally change policy, whether through rules or through statute, to accommodate and solve some of these roadblocks, if you want to call them that. So I appreciate your insights, as usual, and hope that we're able to stay in communication with you on some of these policy issues as we follow those. And I might note, focusing on the budgets of the Department of Revenue to make sure that outreach continues may be a good thing for us to be aware of as well. So thank you so much for taking the time and bringing your report to us. I hope we continue to hear your reports ongoing as well.
Thank you very much.
So to follow up with this little blurb from the Secretary of State's office, I'm going to call up Peter Threlkill from the Secretary of State's office in the Corporations Division. is going to talk to us a little bit about business formation entities. Some real basic information I thought would be somewhat useful to us, as we're always dealing with nomenclatures and LLCs and all these different animals that exist in our business world. So welcome.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, I'm Peter Threlkeld, Director of the Corporation Division, Secretary of State's Office. It's my pleasure to be here before you today. Hopefully I can answer some questions and shed a little clarity on the work that our office does. In many ways, we're the first stop for business in Oregon. We're the place you go to form a new corporation, a new LLC, or file an assumed business name. Ruth, the small business advocate, is also a part of our office, I appreciate the compliments toward the work that she's done. She makes me look smart every day for hiring her in, and I think she's doing a fabulous job. So I had submitted the written testimony. On the first page, you'll see a chart. It talks about active business registrations that we have in Oregon. I like to look at kind of the active number, because it's really sort of the bottom line. That for me, this is the tell as far as how are things are going, and are we increasing year over year, are we gaining, and then that breaks down into some of the different subtypes. So when we look at on the chart, the first black line at the top, you can see that active registrations, and this is all the different business registrations that we have, are growing at about 4% right now. That's over the last year. So it was 4% over the five-year period. We've actually increased since 2009. We've gained about 17,000 new businesses. I will say that you see a little bit of an uptick right there at the far right at the end, and that represents about 10,000 businesses just in the last year that were added. So, and what that tells us is that from about 2008 to about 2012-13, we were pretty flat. We weren't gaining a lot of businesses, but that was also a very rough time in Oregon's economy coming out of the Great Recession. What really makes that up? We look at the next line down, which is the red line. That's assumed business names. Over that period, they've dropped about 10,000 registrations. The trend line is pretty constant, and it has been since 2004. We used to have, at one point, around close to 150,000 assumed business names in Oregon. But that was back in the days when that was a $20 registration for a two-year term. Now that it's $50, we've seen that just continually drop on off. When that fee did increase back in 2004, I had a lot of conversations with some of these small businesses, and they were explaining that they may have registered a half dozen or a dozen different assumed business names. They were trying to cover all the different variations of the name, thinking that what they were really doing was filing a trademark to protect their business name. We had some interesting, conversations that we actually have a trademark registration vehicle if that's what you wanted to do, but an assumed business name really didn't accomplish that. So we've just seen a kind of a continual runoff. A lot of these are probably the smallest businesses. They may well be a sole proprietor. Somebody that's really just starting out, they want to have that doing business as name to go with the business. I think that the trend you'll see here is over the last five-year period, more and more of those businesses have opted into registering a limited liability company. We've actually seen a growth there of about 30,000 LLCs in the last 5 years. There's, I think, a number of reasons for that. Dropping on down, we get down to the purple line, that's our Oregon Business Corporations. Again, that one's off about 10,000 over the period and continuing to drop. And then we get into the lighter blue line. That's all of our foreign business entities. So a foreign corporation is formed outside of the state of Oregon. It could be California. It could be Delaware. It could be a Chinese or Japanese corporation. So they've decided to come in, and they want to do business in the Oregon marketplace. We just lump them all under the category of foreign. Okay. So moving on the second page, here's a chart that talks about new business registrations, and this is the number that we're seeing each of the last 5 years as well. Again, the red line at the top, that's assumed business names, and you'll notice that the dark blue line that's also there, assumed business names and LLCs have sort of switched places. And again, that's a part of that change where we looked at what people are choosing to do as they're forming a new business in Oregon. And then down in the bottom part of the chart where we get into things that are under 5,000 in annual registrations, we see that there's really a lot of static activity. There's not a lot of change overall. I would say that in the new business registration arena, we're running about 60,000 new businesses a year, and that's been pretty constant, I think, through most of the last 5 years. I can look back in the early 2000s, and we had hit a high point of around 70, 72,000 new businesses a year. And we actually had annual growth in the business registrations of 5 to 6%. Those are sort of the heyday, and we haven't really seen that in a while, but again, part of the impact of the Great Recession as Oregon's economy has been struggling to come out of that. I think, though, in the last year, we really have. When you compare these two charts, one of the things that, for me, it really tells us is, even though we don't have a lot of additional new registrations coming online, we're seeing the overall growth go up. So, and that really tells us that the businesses that are out there, they find it worthwhile. You know, they're able to stay in business and keep their registrations. And even though we're not seeing that corresponding increase with the new registration activity, it's overall pretty static.
So just to back up just a second, if I'm reading your charts right, it shows this, though there's a 4% growth in business registrations, it shows a lot of growth in the use of limited liability companies as opposed to, and I don't see subchapter S or corporations listed here. I assume they're part of the other domestic entities. And so those registrations have been, relatively flat. And most, I guess, of the registration growth is in the LLC designation.
So, Chair Holvey, on the first chart, the third line down, which is the dark blue line, that's Oregon Business Corporations. So that's just, I carved those out as wanted to highlight them.
Limited liability.
That's limited liability company. The purple line is Oregon Business Corporations. And so I didn't include professional corporations, co-ops, trusts, other Oregon entities. All the other Oregon entities are down in that little orange line that's kind of almost insignificant. There's only about 8,400 total within the state. So that would be a lot of your law firms, your doctor's offices, some of those, but it's that purple line. That's where we've seen a runoff, and it's down 10,000 over the five-year period. So there's a lot fewer companies are choosing to form as a traditional business corporation. So
it's off 14%. So it's off 14%. Not flat. So it's down 14%, and the use of LLCs is up 28%.
Yes, yes. And I think there's a number of reasons for that. If you go out and you go to SCORE, you go to a small business development center, you go talk to your attorney, pretty much across the board, everybody is advising you to become an LLC. Don't be a sole proprietor. Don't be a general partner. Because those are out there, and you're fully exposed to the liability that your business entity or your business is going to get into. Whereas with an LLC, you have limited liability protection, but it's also provides. It's this hybrid entity. It's like a corporation, but it's like a partnership, and so I can set that up. I've got my personal assets will have liability protection against a suit against the entity, either in a corporation or an LLC. But you also have with the LLC, I can choose to run it like a partnership, so I don't have to go through all the hoops and the minutes and the annual meetings and things that a corporation has to do. So administratively, it's a lot simpler. The LLC, the members who are essentially the owners, they can choose to run the corporate or the LLC, whereas shareholders in a corporation have to appoint directors, and directors hire officers, and the officers run the corporation. I think another big component for the LLC is I have a choice of tax treatment. I can choose to be treated tax like a corporation. Almost nobody does that. Or I can choose to have the income pass through like a partnership, and I'll report that on my personal income tax statement or tax report with the Department of Revenue and the IRS.
Is it possible for a corporation to be a member of an LLC?
A corporation, yes, could register an LLC, and they would be the owner or the member of the LLC.
Mm. Mr. Chair.
Representative Barreto.
Thank you. Do you also have information? This is just businesses or corporations, but do you have numbers that also apply to the GDP or the number of employees or jobs that from beginning to end? You know, like how many we've lost, how many we've gained?
Chair Halvey, Representative Barreto, that's not data that we collect. I know that the Employment Department, U.S. Census, they have some of that data, but that's not something we collect in our system around. I don't actually inquire of the business whether they're a sole operator or an employer, so we don't have that available.
It's a great question, Representative Barreto. It's one that I actually posed to our committee administrator here of looking into some of those more detailed, data that would give us that sort of information. So I'm sort of pursuing whether we can compile that data from both the Department of Revenue and the Employment Department and combine it with the data from the Corporations Division to see if there's something that we can learn from that. But I'll work with you perhaps to follow up with what those exact questions are of those agencies so we can parse out some of that. It's a great
I know
question.
In our experience with, as we pose questions to the Department of Revenue and to the Employment Department, they operate under a number of confidentiality rules that limit the amount of information that they can share, especially when they get into a smaller community. If they gave out information on a certain large employer in Ontario, everybody would know who they were talking about because there's only one.
Right.
And, based on the activity. But I also know that the Employment Department, their folks have in one of their systems, they're able to utilize reports that come more from either a service or at a national level, pulling data out of U.S. Census that's a little bit more transparent and able to be disclosed, whereas a lot of the tax information, a lot of the payroll reporting information, they have some pretty strict limits.
Needless to say, if our community is large enough, we might be able to get some of that data, though.
It could be. Yeah.
But that is one of the challenges with getting that data.
Okay. So we talked a little bit about why people are choosing the limited liability company. I wanted to kind of highlight an example. I chose corporations for what information is actually required when you register that corporation with us. And I think it's important to note that corporations, limited liability companies, they all have roles that are identified in statute. And a role might be an incorporator. So an incorporator, the law says you have to be 18 or another legal entity, and then you have to file articles of incorporation with the Secretary of State. So from that perspective, an incorporator, their role is done. Now, they may be your attorney. They may be a service company that's acting on your behalf. They may be you. And you may be also the owner and the director and the officer. So you may fill a number of different roles in a corporation, but when we talk about what an incorporator is, it's a very limited role. It's a one-time, they filed the initial paperwork, and then that role is pretty much done. That person, you know, may or may not continue on in other roles. So the requirements of a corporation has to have a name, and that has to be in the articles of incorporation. It has to be distinguishable from every other corporation, LLC, other types of business entity, assume business name on the records of the Secretary of State. So in order for us to file it, the corporation has to give us the number of authorized shares in their articles of incorporation. They have to identify a registered agent for service of process, and that registered agent has to give us, or they have to give us, a physical street address. So that's where, if somebody wanted to serve and sue or do a subpoena or something to the registered agent or to the corporation, they could serve that registered agent, and it just facilitates, you know, how that's done. They have to give us the names and the addresses of the incorporators and a mailing address where the Secretary of State can send notices to the corporation. So that's what's required for the formation or the articles at the time that that's done. At the annual report, which in Oregon is a year later, they have to, again, give us the name of the corporation. If it's a foreign corporation, they have to tell us, again, where they're incorporated. So it might be California. It might be the United Kingdom. They have to give us the name and the street address, again, of the registered agent, or confirm that. They have to provide, at this point, the street address and a mailing address for the principal office. So that's where the business is located. They need to give us the names and addresses of the president and the corporate secretary, and also a primary or a description of the primary business activity that the business is conducting. And those are pretty much the requirements, both at formation and at the annual report, that our office collects, and these are noted and set out in statute.
So you do say that one of my questions, I guess, was you do have the street address and mailing address of the principal office of the corporation?
We do.
And is that allowed to also be the same address as the registered agent?
It could be.
So I guess that leads me to a question about corporations that, or any businesses that are registered in Oregon, do you have data that would show how many of them actually are physically doing business in Oregon versus not?
Chair Holvey, no, I would not have. We know that there are instances where somebody may choose to register a business and they may not set up any operations here, so they might utilize that registered agent address as their principal place.
Not required to actually do business in Oregon.
No.
But they can register a business in Oregon.
Yes.
Our sole corporation.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Didn't mean to interrupt you there.
Not a problem. It looked like you had a question. So then we look at how does Oregon compare in our requirements with the requirements in other states. So the majority of states have adopted the Model Business Corporation Act that was put out a number of years ago by the Uniform Law Commission. It's actually Oregon, and about 30 states have done that. But all 50 states have enacted some provisions of the Model Business Corporation Act. And so there's a lot of similarity between what we do here in Oregon and what's done in other states. But, you know, each state being sovereign has its own ability to kind of tweak its law and set out a special requirement here. So when we look at, say, the principal office address, at formation, Oregon doesn't collect that at the time they form. We do collect that at the annual report. There are 23 states that collected at formation. 39 states required it on the annual report. Registered agent, again, that's a role. Their only role is to accept legal service for the corporation. Both Oregon and 49 states require that at formation. Oregon requires it on the annual report. My research didn't include what other states are doing on the annual report, but that's a pretty significant piece of the Model Business Corporation Act. So it's my belief that most states are collecting that as there as well. The incorporator name and address, pretty much everybody requires that at formation, at least for the name. There's looks like about 5 states that don't require an address, nobody collects that on an annual report. Directors and officers, these are the people who exercise control over the corporation. It's optional in Oregon. There are 17 states that either provide it as a required field or it's optional at formation. On the annual report, Oregon requires the officers. That's the president and the secretary. But we do not collect directors at that point. There are 45 states that collect some combination of either the director or the officer information. When we look at the list of shareholders, or who both current, past, and present, who the corporation owners of the corporation are, Oregon law requires that the corporation or either keep that list and maintain it, either at its principal office or its registered agent office. That's pretty similar, we believe, in most other states. But there is no state that requires the corporation to report all of its shareholders to the state. There are a few exceptions to that, and there are 3 states that I was able to find that require some reporting of corporate ownership, and often that's in the annual report. Alaska, they require what they call the alien affiliates that own more than 5% of a corporation. When I talk to Alaska, their main concern is protecting their fishing industry. Mm-hmm. And so they're looking for, are there Japanese corporations that own 5% or more of an Alaska corporation? And they get that into the require that into the filing. So again, it's really driven around how are they able to protect the fishing industry in Alaska. Big business up there. Arizona requires reporting of owners, people that own over 20% of the corporation, as does Arkansas. When we look at limited liability companies, again, the procedures and the requirements very closely mirror what the requirements for corporations are. The roles are a little bit different, as I mentioned before. A member of a corporation is essentially an owner. A member of an LLC is an owner. Under law, we call them members. And an LLC can also have managers. A manager would be very similar to an officer or a director under a business corporation.
So do we require that information from LLCs at their annual report?
At the annual report, we require, if you're a, you have a choice. If you're a member-managed LLC, we require you to report at least one member. If you're a manager-managed LLC, we require you to report the chief manager.
And could an agent suffice as that member in that report?
Not under Oregon law. So it would have to be who's the, so it couldn't be a nominee. You couldn't give us a somebody that was sort of a stand-in. It's the statute's very clear. It's who are the members. Now we're not requiring all members though at that point for a member managed LLC. Just they have to name one.
And it couldn't be the agent of the LLC like the agent of a corporation.
There are some situations where, as an agent, I can be my own agent. So, so say I'm a sole member LLC. I'm the only person. Basically I'm a sole proprietor, but I chose to register as an LLC. I don't want to pay an attorney to, $150 a year to provide a registered agent service for me. I'm there at the principal office. I'm very capable of signing for receipt of legal service. If I'm willing to do that, I can be both roles. So okay. I could be both at that point. Okay. Did want to talk a little bit about the concept of beneficial ownership information. This is really something that started to come up across the country about a decade ago. The federal government started to have some concerns, primarily law enforcement, the FBI, other agencies of the federal government, around the ease of foreign criminal organizations registering business or registering companies in the United States for the purpose of facilitating crime overseas, primarily around money laundering, but also terrorist financing. So the federal government started to come up with a number of different proposals. There's been quite a handful of bills that have been introduced in Congress over the years. So far, none of them have materialized into law. Congress has kind of gone back and forth a little bit about what they want to do or what they don't want to do, trying to get to a requirement or set up a process for the collection of beneficial ownership information. And basically, beneficial ownership in most definitions comes down to a person who has control or significant control over the assets or the finances of a corporation or a limited liability company. So they're able to direct and control those funds. What has come up over the years, the Uniform Law Commission, in cooperation with the American Bar Association and the National Association of Secretaries of State, developed an alternative model act as something that the states could do instead of requiring all of corporations and LLCs to report all of their shareholder information into the public record. The Alternative Act provides a mechanism where law enforcement has maybe an easier opportunity to gather or get a hold of that information from a records officer, from the registered agent, without necessarily alerting a corporation that they're under federal investigation. Again, we've talked about that, I think, in this committee before, and that legislation hasn't been adopted by any state either at this point. In the meantime, the federal government, through the U.S. Treasury, has decided that they needed to do something to assist law enforcement. So in 2012, the IRS required all corporate entities must register and file for a federal employee tax ID number. And with that, they require every corporation to report their responsible party. So that's that person that has the significant control over the assets of the corporation or the finances of the corporation. The IRS is required to share that with appropriate law enforcement agencies in an investigation. So that in the last few years has been something that's developed, that's been put in place, and is currently available to law enforcement to help facilitate. It creates that single point of registration, a database for where that information is collected. It also eliminates or avoids any duplication of effort across the 50 states. Along with that, the Treasury Department has started requiring the what's called the FBAR report. It's the Foreign Bank Financial Account report. If you've ever set up in the last two or three years automatic deposit or automatic transfer from one account to another through your bank, you've been required to answer some questions about, is any of the funds either coming from a foreign institution or going to a foreign institution? That's that FBAR report. And so people are having to report that in. That goes to the federal government. They're able to use that to track where the flow of money is going. And again, it comes back to how they're trying to get a handle on and defeat money laundering activity.
So does the State Department of Revenue and our law enforcement agencies also have access to that those reports?
Chair Holvey, I don't have the answer to that information.
Okay. This might be a good point to bring up Lane Shetterly before you're pretty close to your end, and he was talking on this same subject matter. So,
okay.
We'll give you a couple minutes to make a couple final.
Okay. Thank you. Last year, the U.S. Treasury's Financial Crimes Enforcement Network, or FinCEN, proposed new customer due diligence requirements for financial institutions, and basically that would be a requirement that when the banks are setting up new accounts or getting ready to engage in a wire transfer transaction, the bank is required to collect that beneficial ownership information. Now, it's closer to the point of potential money laundering, getting the banks to do it. A decade ago, there was a lot of resistance from the banks to, trying to collect this information, and now there's more of a push. That hasn't been adopted as a final rule, but that's been the direction that Treasury's going. So we think that there's a number of these tools are really kind of helping to facilitate and provide that information that helps the law enforcement agencies. So thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate that. And welcome, Mr. Shetterly. And you can sort of pick up with this conversation.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Anywhere you'd like to just plug in.
Sure, members of the committee, Lane Shetterly. I'm here today as a uniform law commissioner from Oregon, and the chair asked me to report on the status of the Uniform Law Enforcement Access to Entity Information Act. Peter mentioned that, and in fact, the last page of his testimony pretty well deals with that history, and he's largely given my testimony. Just to recap, this.
Sorry about
no,
that.
No, no, no. I'm happy. I'm sure.
We're happy. We're happy for that, too. No.
This really was born out of an interest. I think Carl Levinson, and Carl Levin was the primary mover in Congress behind federal legislation. The federal legislation would have imposed significant regulatory requirements on corporations and also record keeping on secretaries of state, which caused concern among those groups. So they came to the Uniform Law Commission with the proposal that the Uniform Law Commission adopt a state-initiated alternative to the federal legislation. And so for actually several years, worked in concert with the FBI, with the Department of Justice, and with Senator Levin and other members of Congress to try and draft a state act that would respond to the federal interest in this subject, but be less onerous on both businesses and secretaries of states in terms of the filing and record-keeping requirements. As Peter suggested, the federal target sort of kept shifting. It was never entirely certain what the federal response to this was going to be. Senator Levin kept reintroducing various versions of federal act, and ultimately he's left, of course, the Congress. And to my knowledge, and Peter, you may know better, I don't know that there's a champion at this point actively pursuing federal legislation the way Senator Levin was anyway at the time. And so the Uniform Act was really drafted in that period of time as a response to really try and get ahead of federal legislation on a less burdensome basis. Since federal policy and action really was never very well defined, and since these other sources of information have come to the fore that Peter also mentioned that are also in my written testimony, at this point, the Uniform Law Commission is advising states not to adopt the Uniform Act, and Peter is correct that no states have, just for the sense that since this was designed for a very specific purpose to get in front of a particular federal regime, federal legislation, and it's unsure at this point whether the federal government is going to be pursuing that beyond these other avenues for information that are available. The sense was that this is not an area where states necessarily would be interested in going on their own. And so at this point, Peter is correct, no states have adopted it. The Uniform Law Commission is not recommending it for adoption. It is out there, but it's sort of in a hiatus status at this point. And, Mr. Chair, I'll end my testimony with that and be happy to answer any questions.
Questions? See, everybody's got a question on this. I did notice that in Peter's testimony that Alaska, Arizona, and Arkansas were requiring owner information. And so I'm assuming that they're sort of going against the Uniform Law Commission when they did that.
Mr. Chair,
the Uniform Law Commission's recommendation.
Yeah,
anyway.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, not necessarily. The Uniform Act, as Peter mentioned, required the appointment of a records keeper who law enforcement could go to without going to the corporation directly and get a host of information on officers and directors and shareholders of a corporation. What I think Alaska and Arizona and Arkansas have is a much more straightforward reporting requirement that actually goes to the Secretary of State directly from the corporation. So it doesn't have that piece in it of an independent party to whom law enforcement goes separate from the corporation itself. I don't think there's necessarily any conflict with the Uniform Law with the position of the Uniform Law Commission in having states impose some direct reporting requirement of shareholder identification to the Secretary of State.
Chair Hovey, those three states, their statutes did not appear to be in response to either the Uniform Law Act or federal legislation. It seems that they've had that requirement a number of years before.
So in that regard, in Oregon, we've toyed with different measures to require some accountability for businesses that are doing business with state government, i.e. that they don't owe the state a lot of money in taxes or other sorts of criminal behavior by their beneficial owners. And so lacking the state's ability to really identify the owners, there doesn't seem to be a pathway to accomplish, you know, that public policy. And so do you see another avenue for the state to drill down on that so that we don't have, you know, for instance, out-of-state corporations, you know, who walk away from Oregon owing them money, and then coming back under a new name and doing the same thing again?
Chair Holvey, as we've looked at that particular issue, example comes up like the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. So, and other licensing agencies will often require the collection of, you know, those who are the key owners. And I know in the case of OLCC, they're really looking for and trying to weed out anybody that's had any prior activity with organized crime or criminal activity or fraud or those types of things. So the mechanisms that are in place for those licensing agencies, they're already collecting that information at the time a license application is coming in. So they are weeding that out based on that supplemental license application. So, you know, where, and that becomes a part of their approval process.
And Mr. Chair, if I may, on the subject of public contracting, I don't have it specifically, but there is a requirement in public contracting that out-of-state bidders certify in their bid or proposal that they are registered with the Department of Revenue for tax reporting purposes. Of course, in-state we have those already, but for out-of-state corporations, if they are businesses, I should say, if they're bidding on a public contract, they do have to certify that they are compliant for tax purposes.
So I guess the last thing that's in my mind on this subject matter, is there, examples from other states that require business entities that form in their state to actually do business in the state? Getting at some foreign corporations that register businesses here that actually don't even do businesses here?
Mr. Chair, I'm not aware of any. In fact, Delaware, of course, has made it part of their revenue system to encourage corporations to file in Delaware, pay the filing fees there, be regulated by Delaware law. And you have lots of corporations that are registered in Delaware that don't do business in Delaware, for instance. That's their, that's one of their sources of revenue. So I don't know that there's any state that requires that you do business in the state that you file.
I think their motto is the incorporation state.
That's so correct.
Yes, I know.
And I believe they fund a third of their general fund off those fees. I'm not aware of any corporation or any state that actually requires that. And typically what we see with a foreign corporation, they're applying for authority to do business in Oregon. So it's that California corporation that wants to come up and open up a factory like Amy's, you know, Organic Foods did a few years ago. They want to come in to Oregon, set up shop, and do some business here, they're going to apply as a foreign corporation. I think the issue that we see most often is they'll register as an Oregon corporation, but they'll never have they'll never come and do business here. And so, I mean, that kind of gets back to the original shell company type of an issue, and that was again back to that money laundering issue when that first came up a decade ago. We went out and did some research. We looked at the websites of the intermediaries that were in places like Belize and the Cayman Islands and Gibraltar and Seychelles, and you know, they advised their clients that if they were going to set up a company in the United States, say you came into Oregon or Wyoming, you set up a new corporation, you know, their first advice was just register the business, don't have any operations there, don't have any profits there, don't have any employees there. And then what you do is you're able to circumvent tax laws and other reporting requirements so that the state doesn't have anything to go back. And that was our first proposed solution to shell companies was let's close the loopholes. The IRS said that if you didn't have operations, or the tax authority said if you didn't have operations or income, you didn't have to file a report. I think in Oregon, with ballot measure 67, I think, required, expanded the minimum tax. And so at the very least, they have to file a tax report now. Now, whether on the compliance side they're actually doing that, the IRS doesn't share that information, or the Revenue Department doesn't share that information. But, you know, that really goes back to the Al Capone theory. You know, Al Capone was a bad guy, committed a lot of crimes. He went to prison for tax evasion. So if you can get them exposed to a tax filing requirement, you know, then you have more of an ability, even if you can't prosecute them on the actual crimes they're committing, because they're just too wily. You start to create a little bit broader net, and as a way to either, and in most cases, what you would find is they'll go elsewhere.
Do you know what the cost difference, or what does it cost in New Jersey to incorporate or file a business entity compared to Oregon?
Chair Hovey, I don't have that information at the top of my head. I have it back at my office. I'd be happy to provide that to you.
Okay, all right. Solve my curiosity. Representative Widener.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Kind of just with all the testimony we've had today and stuff, it's kind of spurred something, because you do track all the corporations here in Oregon, or that register here in Oregon. And I know companies that are actually doing things here, but they're registered in Delaware as a corporation. And I'm just wondering, have you tracked any decisions that we've made here, any policy changes that we've made to make corporations stop filing, like state-run banks, where we start saying, well, we're going to do more things to state-run banks via policy, then all of a sudden you don't see them refiling and they're becoming national charters? Have you tracked that information? And if you have, it would be great for this committee to have that information.
Chair Hovey, Representative Widener, we don't have that type of empirical information available, really. We do track dissolutions primarily. There's three different ways a company can dissolve. A voluntary dissolution is they choose to submit and file articles of dissolution, and that's either because of an action by the shareholders or the directors, and they've chosen that for their own reason. Administrative dissolution is when they didn't pay us a fee, they didn't file the annual report, they didn't maintain a registered agent, their duration expired, so the Secretary of State's taken action against them. And the other types of dissolution are all court-ordered. So they got in trouble, and a judge issued an order and said, I'm going to shut them down. So, but as far as tracking some of what are the underlying reasons that they're choosing to not re-register, I don't have that. But the vast majority of them are, they just didn't file an annual report. And so, you know, I don't have kind of that data about what caused that. The actual example there, I think, a state bank. That's one of the one examples where they don't actually register with us. They register with and they incorporate under DCBS law. So,
I don't have any empirical information either that I can tell you. I do some small business and corporate and limited liability company work. Anecdotally, what you hear is that, you know, Delaware is more favorable. It's how it regulates corporations, how it regulates business entities. It's more favorable in its regulation to business entities, and that's why they file there. It's not a question of filing fees so much as it is what you have to do as a Delaware corporation and opportunities that are available to you that aren't available in other states. Frankly, I think that with the broad adoption of the Model Business Corporation Act, Delaware is trading on a lot of old history in terms of that reputation. But there is, in fact, primarily for the more sophisticated and larger business entities that I don't work with, I do understand still opportunities available in Delaware that are not available through their regulatory system, at least as easily in other states. So that's what drives, I think, some states in the filings there is just that they have a friendly or regulatory climate to corporations. And one of the reasons, too, that the Uniform Law Commission was concerned about encouraging the adoption of the Law Enforcement Entity Information Act, and that that first state that adopts it might see a decline in its business filings because it would be perceived as a competitive disadvantage among the other states where corporations could go ahead and file somewhere else.
I would add to that that Delaware does have the Chancery Court, and that's a huge advantage for the business community because it's made up of judges that only ever hear business cases. And I know a little over a decade ago, Oregon kind of toyed with the idea of should we do something similar so that when a business has a case that's heard by a judge, the judge didn't necessarily just get finished hearing a child custody case or a divorce or an auto accident type of a case. It does allow the judges that are hearing those cases in Delaware to really specialize in business law. And so they have a greater depth of understanding where, not that we don't have good judges here, it's just we ask them to really cover the whole gamut of Oregon law and what they're making decisions about. So that is an advantage for Delaware.
Mr. Chair, if I may add on to that, a lot of the NDAs that I end up in and that we're negotiating with, all of them are to be held in Delaware. So that's kind of the location for a lot of this stuff because of that.
And probably a lot of money laundering as well.
And a non-disclosure agreement?
No, in Delaware. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
For your information, and thank you especially for the links to the white papers and your testimony.
I
think it'll be a very interesting look at. Thanks again.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Committee, I neglected to have introductions. Seeing how everybody is returning from the regular session, I didn't think that was necessary, though I believe we have a committee assistant that has not always been with us.
And she's leaving.
Oh, and she's leaving. So
that was quick.
Well, why don't you introduce yourself and then announce that you're leaving.
My name is Jessica Wangler. I've been a committee assistant since 2013.
Where are you going?
I'm going to work for the party.
Well, very good. Welcome and good luck. And so with that, I will adjourn the House Interim Committee on Business and Labor.
Here we go.
Business and Labor.